Okay, so my goal today is we're basically going to kind of pick up where we left off last time. I'll back up just briefly. We'll do a review of all pronouns because we got about 2/3 through the pronouns last time. So we'll come back. We'll just review what we covered, introduce what we didn't get to. And then if possible, we might even be able to tackle adjectives. There's not a lot with adjectives, but there's enough to, you know, merit a discussion so you can understand and see what's coming. So again, pronouns, just by way of review, it is, they're also, that's why we started with case endings, because case endings help you with like four major parts of speech. So you're already halfway through your parts of speech once you learn noun case endings, and then you learn like the article, pronouns, adjectives, which is next tonight. You can start making some good progress. So pronouns are just like nouns in that they have case, gender, person, and number, right? So nominative, genitive, dative, accusative are your cases. And just by way of review, which one? Nominative, what does that tell you about the function of a word in the sentence?
Subject.
Excellent. Genitive, what would you say there? Yes, most of the time possessive or an attribute of something, or it's somehow relating the nouns. But most often possessive or an attribute. Dative. Good. Often indirect object of the sentence or instrument, like a means in with, by. And then accusative.
Direct.
Yeah, direct object of the verb. Yep, good. That's your main uses. So then gender, masculine, feminine, neuter, person, first, second, third, and then number, singular, or plural. So pronouns are just like nouns in that. But pronouns are used to replace nouns. They help reduce redundancy in language so that we do not have to keep repeating the key noun. A pronoun will always agree with its antecedent, that is the noun to which it refers, in gender and number. And so, and there's a few contexts that's important where it's like there's a different gender number. And so you have to figure out which noun the pronoun goes with. So, but a pronoun will always agree with its antecedent in gender and number. Again, just by way of observation, we talked about this last time, but there are about 16,500 pronouns in the New Testament. So in other words, they show up in 4 out of every 5 verses. You're going to encounter these all over the place. So it does behoove you to, you know, go slow and try and work through your pronoun list because they are so frequent. But then there's a lot of fun stuff about it too. It's part of... we'll talk about it a little bit more, review it, but John in particular, because we're spending a lot of time as, you know, beginning Greek students, John's writings, either the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, even Revelation, but Revelation has simple grammar, it just has tough vocabulary, because it has a lot of words that you don't encounter very often, and so it's a little tougher on vocabulary, but it's really simple grammar, but it's interesting. Pronouns, there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with pronouns, and particularly the demonstrative pronoun, John loves that. Gospel of John, it is everywhere. Scholars will call that your idiolect. I don't know if you ever heard of that. Idiolect means, you know, idios comes from the Greek. It means one's own. So it's the way a particular author speaks. Just what is their normal, you know, idiosyncrasies. Syncrasies, that's hard for me to say. It's the same idea. Like when they write or they speak, they have manners of speech that are detectable. And John in particular loves the use of pronouns. So it's fun to kind of get into that. So we talked about, well, on this list, right, there's 8 major types of pronouns. Personal pronouns, possessive, reflexive, reciprocal, demonstrative, indefinite, relative, and interrogative. And this is actually a list from an English website, but it's the same for Greek, is it's the same types of pronouns are also present in Greek. So I just showed you the forms last time, which I'll just kind of flash those up again. But then we're starting to talk about uses and where it kind of gets interesting in the reading and interpretation of Greek. So your personal pronouns, this is your first and second person. So ego, emu, emoi, eme. And then plural, hemes, hemon, hemin, hemas. So that's your first person. And again, that's actually not too hard to remember if you're familiar with philosophy in any form. The ego, someone's ego. What's that? What's that?
I.
Yeah, exactly. So it means I. Exactly. So it's first person. It's actually a Greek word, first person, singular nominative form, personal pronoun. So it's the I, right? Someone's ego. It's all about themselves. So second person is the sigma, the su. And then you have the su with a omicron, upsilon, genitive, soi, se, humes. Again, and the u just helps you remember in the plural. Humes, humon, humin, humas is the u. Right? So it's second person. You. That's second person personal pronoun. Then your third person is autos, autu, auto, auton. Again, we have this in English. Where do we use the term autos? Or remember, we use the illustration of an autobiography. What's an autobiography? Exactly. So someone, they're writing a biography about themselves. So it's actually the word him, himself. So he's writing about himself, an autobiography. So auto, it's actually a third person personal pronoun. Autos, autu, auto, auton. And then this is just, you see it in masculine, feminine, neuter, right? The feminine would have your eta endings and your neuter will have your neuter endings. And so again, case endings are really helpful there. You've already learned the asu, o, on, oi, on, ois, us. Remember in singular, you just spell the word sin. Remember that? In the masculine, the sigma is going to be on the nominative. Remember that? The iota is always a giveaway of what case? Dative. It often appears in the as a subscript, you know, a superscript, underneath the letter. But then in the plural, it's actually written out all the way, autois. So everyone, can you see that with your... So there's your plural, iota. And then there's your subscript iota right there. And then the new, the N in your sin word, is on your accusative. Right? But only, that sin only works in singular. So there's your S-I-N. But when you go feminine, don't forget, it actually swaps. The sigma is actually on the genitive, not the nominative. But you have your S, your I, your N right there. So you spell sin. And then the own, recall that, plural. That's true of every gender in the plural. It's your genitive plural ending. So there are shortcuts, or I mean just observations you can make to try and help you remember. But we made the point last time that, and this is where it's kind of fun, like pronouns are used to provide... Either it reduces redundancy, right? It just drops, you know, a pronoun replaces the noun so that rather than saying the proper name, Jesus, 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 all the way through the passage, you say Jesus, you know, at the beginning, and then it's like he, right? It just, it condenses language. But also it can be emphatic. Remember this? And this is kind of fun. If a nominative personal pronoun occurs with a verb, the pronoun is emphatic because the subject of a verb is implicit in the form of the verb itself. So this is one of the famous I am statements of Jesus, John 11:25. So it's a pen aute ha Iesus. And then right here is what we're after, ego eimi, right there. So ego, right? That's your first person personal pronoun. But then eimi is the verb. And we'll learn this more when we get to verbs, but the verb has person number built into it. So you actually don't have to say ego in this sentence. You could just say eimi. I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus is saying. But when he puts the pronoun before the verb, then it's emphatic. I myself am. Most English translations won't do that, which is why in Greek, you see it in Greek, like we're saying, right? You're seeing it in HD color versus black and white. You'll see it in Greek, but rarely does that come across in English. Some English translations in some contexts will try to bring that out. But in English, the only way you could really emphasize it is say, I myself am. Like you kind of make it redundant, right? Which is bad English. Like we don't talk that way. But it's in Greek, that's what's going on. It's emphatic. Now, do you remember, and there's a cool one. I think I have it coming up in another couple slides. But the emphatic I am statements of Jesus through the Gospel of John are emphatic. Ego, eimi. Well, then, you remember in John 3, I think we talked about this a little bit last time, John the Baptist, when he is insisting he's not the Messiah, he actually uses ego eimi with the uk in front. I myself am not. Like, it's very emphatic. I am not the Messiah. And so it's kind of fun to see that, you know, again, you don't see that mostly in English. It's more of a Greek thing. But another example of that, 1 John 4:19 is, so here you actually see it twice. So this, someone, Andrew, let's start with that. Can you read those two underlined words in Greek? The first two in the sentence.
Hemes, agapomen.
Well done. Hemes, agapomen. So agapomen, you could just leave that by itself. Like, it's because the word, the agapomen, the men on the end is the first person plural ending. So it's we love. But when he puts humes in the front, we ourselves love, right? It's emphatic. We ourselves love because, hati, and then what's that? He, so that's your third person personal pronoun, right? The autobiography, autos, because he, and it's os, masculine. So what gender is that? Oh, I'm sorry, I just said gender. What case is that, the os ending, remember? Good. So there's your nominative. So it's functioning how in the sentence? It's a subject. So we ourselves love because he first, and then this is the word agape, but it's in the aorist, but he himself loved us, first loved us. So notice the autos and the agape sen, it's emphatic, right? It's a pronoun. But you don't need the pronoun because the subject's already built into the verb. So when he states it, it's emphatic. We ourselves love because he himself first loved us. Does that make sense? And John loves this. It's all over the New Testament, but John in particular loves the use of the emphatic pronoun. He loves that. But here's another example. This is in Mark 9 or 8, 29 is, and I give you the English down here, but let's see, who else wants to? Okay, Gabe, can you read that in Greek? First word.
Oh, hold on, let me think for a second.
Okay, think about that one, because Sean, you got the next one. Well, the two, because I'm not going to just let you off with an article. that's cheating. All right, and then Eric the elder, because Eric the younger's not here. You got that word. Then we'll just go straight back, Corey, that one. Here we go. Those two will be John, and then we'll let you end it over there, Elise. Okay, go ahead. What'd you say?
Apocryphius.
Good, apocryphthes. Yeah, because that's the diphthong.
Yeah,
yep, good. That's good. Apocryphthes. Excellent. Okay, and then apocryphthes.
Ha Petras.
Ha Petras, which is Peter, right? It's like, oh, that one's easy. I got that one. I know what that means. Okay, what do you got?
Nothing yet.
Nothing wrong with that. That's okay.
Well, I don't know.
Good. Yeah, you started with the L sound, so it's lambda.
Legay.
Legay.
Okay.
Yep.
I've even had that one a couple weeks ago.
Ah, see, there we go. We're just warming up the old mental juices here. This is good. Okay, Corey, what you got?
I got nothing.
This one right here, you got it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're good. Auto. So what is that? That's what we're talking about. It's a pronoun. What kind of pronoun is that? Good. So it's dative case. It's your third person personal pronoun, what we just finished studying or just looked at the forms of it. So auto, but it's dative. So it's functioning how in the sentence? Yeah, indirect object. So Peter is the subject, right? Because that's in the nominative. Ha Petras. Answered. In English, we put the subject first, right? But notice in Greek, normal default word order is the verb goes first. There's some debate on that. but that's the consensus at the moment, is that the verb goes first, and then your subject, and then your object. So here it's a little bit redundant because it's answered and said. So Peter answered him and said, I didn't put the and said in there, to him. And then John?
Sue A.
Good, Sue A. So that's another one. What's that? That's an good. That's another pronoun, right? We just talked about the personal pronouns. That's the second person personal pronoun, you. But then A, that's just the, it's a form of A, me. So it's the second person singular, but of A, me. So Sue A is you yourself. Notice again, it's redundant. You yourself. So it's the pronoun plus the verb, and the subject's built into the verb. So when you have it spelled out, it's emphatic. So you yourself are, and then final two words?
Christos.
Good. Christos. Yeah, os. The O is the omega. Excellent. Ha Christos. So Peter answered him and said, which I don't have that in the English, so shame on me. You yourself are the Christ. But notice again, I think it's interesting where Jesus says, you know, I am emphatic. Well, here Peter's being emphatic. You yourself are the Christ. Right? So you can almost hear his tone of voice as he's saying it emphatic. Okay, Mark 10, 28 is, again, we can go for sake of time, we'll go a little faster. But so Peter, so where's your, you see that in the subject of your sentence in nominative. So Peter, and that's actually the word, it's the verb began, and this is actually, we'll talk about it later. That is from lego, means to speak, but it's actually the infinitive form. So it's Peter began to say or began to speak to him. Notice again, there's another third person personal pronoun. That one just singular dative. So he said to him, idu, that's behold. And then there's another one. What's that one? Hey, mace. Good, so it's another personal pronoun, right, that we were just looking at. It's plural. So we, first person, plural. Plural. We ourselves, and then have left or have forsaken. We ourselves have left or forsaken everything and followed you. And so, which is, again, remember this is in the rich young ruler, right? And so Peter's, again, he's kind of emphatic. He's like, we have left everything. And what are we getting out of this, right? I mean, so, but again, in the Greek, you can see his emphasis because it's redundant. We ourselves have left everything. And then also there's one more. Sorry, I'm kind of marking over my own mark, but soy. That's another personal pronoun, right? Because we have left all to follow you. Right? So that's a second person personal pronoun, you. What would that be? Singular dative. All right. So see how that works? The emphatic use of the pronoun, kind of fun. Keep an eye out for that. It's all over the place. Okay, so the next one, after personal pronouns, you have possessive pronouns. And this is my, right? So it's mine or yours. So you have first person or second person. Emas, eme, eman, hemeteras, hemetera, hemeteran. Singular, plural, first person, possessive. Mine or yours would be second person. Sas, se, son, hemeteras, hemetera, hemeteran. All right, so those are, again, pretty common, right? We just use, they'll show up in Greek consistently, but it's just like our possessive pronoun. That's my coffee. That's my table. That's my family, my whatever, fill in the blank. But it's mine, right? It's possessive. So there's your possessive pronoun forms. Then you have the relative pronoun. So the relative pronoun always introduces a relative clause. This is where you normally, you would translate it, which, what, who, something like that. But what it does is it starts a relative clause. And so it extends, it kind of elaborates, it gives you more information about something or someone that was just mentioned. And notice these are pretty easy to distinguish because they're just your case endings. See that? It's os, u, o, on, oi, on, ois, us. But you have a rough breather and an accent or a circumflex over the top of a couple of the forms. But you see that? These, if you know your case endings, this is just your case endings with a rough breather and an accent mark. So has, hu, ho, han, hoi, on, hois, hoos. And then your feminine, hey, heis, hey, hein, hai, hon, hai, heis, has. Then your neuter, ha, hu, ho, ha. And then neuter plural, ha, but alpha, hon, hois, ha. All right, so again, you see how those? It's so handy to just learn your case endings as best you can because it's going to give you a shortcut to, again, four or five major parts of speech. It's going to really help you. But just talk about these real quick. They're actually really important. Relative clauses are very frequent in the New Testament, particularly in Paul. Paul loves relative clauses because he likes long sentences, long and complex sentences. But a relative pronoun always introduces a relative clause, which is always subordinate to the main clause. A relative clause never expresses the main idea of the sentence. Typically, relative pronouns are hinge words in that they refer to a word in the previous clause and adds further information that we need to know. So the example I gave you, there's a ton. This is just the first one that came to my mind. The example I gave you last time was 1 Peter chapter 1, 7 and 8. So at the very end of verse 7, this underlined part is the end of verse 7. So, anyone bold enough to venture a read there? Those four words, what are they? And we got this. This is how we get better, guys. You're doing great. Doing great. First word. N. Well done. Okay, I was going to say, someone just take the easy one. It's good. Well done. N. What's the next word?
Apocalypse.
Ah, well done. Boy, we made it sound like a champ. Apocalypse. And then next two words. Jesu Christu, which is?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ, good. What case is that in? Ooh, ooh, ooh ending.
Genitive.
Good, genitive singular. Good, masculine genitive singular. So, humes, I'm sorry, Jesus Christu. So it's at the revelation of Jesus Christ was the final phrase of the last verse. Well, now here is our relative particle, han, or I'm sorry, relative pronoun, han. So what do you, tell me what about that. What do you recognize? What's han? I mean, it's a relative pronoun, but gender, case, number, han. Good, because the n, right? So sin, think sin, n, accusative. Good. Singular. Good. So han, and then, so in this case, it's, notice my English translation below, in or at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom? So that's your relative pronoun. He's still going to talk about Jesus Christ, but he's going to spend another whole verse talking about Jesus. But it's like, it's not the main point. Right, because the main point of his paragraph was in the previous verse, but he's trying to extend and elaborate and give you more information about Jesus, and so he begins it with a relative pronoun. Who, whom, and why do we say whom instead of who? Familiar with that? Like, what's the difference between who or whom in English? It's a subject versus object, all right? So whom is an object. Subject would be who.
I thought it was the difference between good
and
bad English.
Yeah, that too. Right. Well said.
I think those two have been squashed together.
It is. It's true. You're right. It's not very, yeah, it's very much squashed together. You're right. You're right. It's probably rare now.
You'll have to read something
pre-1900. Like anything in the 1900s? Like pre-2000?
Yeah. No, I would say pre-1950s for sure.
Really? Woof. Wow. Interesting. Well, King James is pre-1950s. Right? It says whom. Okay, but why is it whom?
I do.
What was that?
I still judge authors. I'm like, Like, yeah. Real author, you're saying whom for an object.
That's right. Whom is the object, okay? But notice in the English, I say whom. Why? Because what case is the han in? We said it a moment ago. It's accusative. So how does an accusative function in the sentence? It's the object. So it's not Jesus doing the seeing. It's whom not seeing you love. So the subject is actually right here. It's embedded in the verb. The subject is you. The object is Jesus, whom having not seen you love. Do you see how that works? Because the whom, or the han, the relative pronoun, is telling you about Jesus, but he's functioning as the object. He's not the one doing the seeing. Whom, that's your negative, not, this is a participle, seeing. Whom not seeing you love. Do you see how that works? So in that little clause right there, your subject is embedded in the verb. You love. And then the han, which is referring to Jesus, is the object, whom having not seen, you love. He goes on, in whom, so notice he does it again. He's continuing. This is actually, he's stacking relative pronouns on top of each other, relative clauses. Whom having not seen, you love. In whom, RT, now, not beholding. It's just, it's another word for see. It's just a little bit different word, but it's who now not beholding. And this one, I know you Greek scholars know that one. It's another participle, but believing. It's from pistuo, to believe. Believing, but believing, and then you rejoice. So the subject is again embedded in that verb at the end. There, you rejoice. So you see how that works? These relative pronouns pop up all over, particularly in the epistles, but it's a relative pronoun begins a relative clause, which is actually, it's not an independent statement. It's not an independent sentence. It's connected to the previous sentence. It's an elaboration. It's elongating. It's trying to add more information that you might want to know about a previous, something said in the previous sentence or the previous clause. Does that make sense?
So in English, it's kind of like that phrase that's trapped between commas. It's just like extra input.
Yes.
Is that kind of what that is?
And in English, that's typically like a relative pronoun is your who, what, that. Something like that. So it's an extended, exactly. It's like typically between commas. It's like an extra clause. Like if it can't stand alone as a sentence, it's a dependent, not an independent clause. It's a dependent clause. It requires, it's not a complete thought on its own. So relative pronouns are helpful when you're doing exegesis, you know, through a passage, because it tells you, it helps outline the passage for you. It tells you what are the main clauses and then what are the subordinate clauses. A relative clause is always going to be a subordinate clause. It's never an independent standalone clause. And so that's helpful in a number of contexts. All right? Yeah.
What's the, because pistuo ontes is from pistuo. What's the ontes ending again?
So it's a present active participle.
Participle.
Yeah, so that's why I translate it here, believing, right there. So he says, in whom now not seeing, normally it's yet believing, you rejoice. Because the de is like the yet or and also believing, you rejoice. We'll talk about this later in participles. I can't wait to talk about participles. They are one of the more complex parts of Greek, but there is so many cool things you can do with participles. But participles, so like in that phrase, you have a finite verb, you rejoice. That's your normal, you know, strong indicative verb. We'll talk about it when we talk about verbs. So that's your main idea. Believing is in the participle form, and it backgrounds the verb. Now, there's different ways. We'll talk about that. But like in a lot of English translations don't always bring that out, but in Greek, you can actually see which verb in the sentence is the most prominent verb, where it's the finite verb. that is given the primary emphasis, and then they will background other actions, usually using participles, infinitives, different constructions, but participles and infinitives most frequently. So in this case, it's believing you rejoice. In other words, it's and there can function different ways. This is kind of a, because it comes before the verb, it's the idea is that after having believed, you rejoice. So rejoice is the key idea, but it's really not possible without the believing, right? It's like after having believed, you rejoice, or because it's in the present, while you were believing, you rejoice. So I know that's a little beyond where we're at right now, but we'll get there. But it's really, really fun. The Great Commission is the classic. There's a lot of places to go. But you're familiar with the Great Commission, Matthew chapter 28, 19 and 20. So in that, you have several verbal ideas. But which one's the main one, right? So like you don't, have you heard this before? I know you guys have probably heard this before. But in, let me just, since I'm on it, all right, let's go there real quick. So grab your Bibles or just look as I read or as I pull it up. There we go. So this is Matthew 28, 19 and 20. And can you quote it in English? Here, I'll let you cheat. There's the English right over here. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. Lo, I'm with you always, even the end of the age. All right, so what's interesting is going is a participle. Baptizing is a participle. And teaching is a participle. Those are not the main verbs of the sentence. There's actually only one finite verb in that, which is right here. Anyone, can you pronounce that? The highlighted one. Did it highlight? Yeah, kind of.
Mate tu sate.
Well done. Mate tu sate. Well done. So it's mate tes is the noun, means disciple. Here it's the verb form make disciples. So what's the primary command? And that's actually in the imperative form. So it's a command. The command is make disciples. The going, there's some debate. We'll talk about participle uses. You know, like what does that mean? While you're going, having gone. But the idea, the main command is not go. The main command is while you're going. While you're living life, wherever you might be, make disciples. Well, then you have two participles that follow the imperative. And it's elaborating. It's telling you how to make disciples. There's two things you do to make disciples. What are they?
Baptizing and teaching.
Exactly. So the core concept of the verse, the two verses, the commission, is make disciples. That's the verb. That's the finite verb, the imperative. That's the main thrust of the passage. But then he's saying, do it while you're going, and then you do it. So that's kind of like the when you do it is going, make disciples, and then the how is baptizing and teaching them. Does that make sense? So it's a lot of fun. When you start getting into, and I know we haven't, I'm just kind of introducing you to it, but we'll get to verbs later, soon. Hopefully in another, I don't know, 3-4 weeks, we might get to verbs. But verbs are, that's your workhorses of the language. But learning the different verb forms can be very helpful because the grammar helps you understand what he's saying and where the emphasis lies. And so participles are a lot of fun, so we'll get to that later. But thoughts on that, questions on that before we, I'm trying to tantalize you with some fun verb stuff, but that's later. We'll get to verbs, right? But I don't want you to be intimidated. Verbs is like the toughest part of the language. Like, you know, we cover every other major part of speech in the first, you know, I don't know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. And then we spend like the rest of the class on verbs because there's so much to learn about verbs. But it's worth it because there's just so much data, so much interesting stuff. Okay, so that was a freebie. Back to pronouns. Okay, so this one we talked about last time, the near and the far demonstrative. So this is this, that, These, those. That's what a demonstrative pronoun is. The near would be the this or these, this in the singular, these in the plural. The far demonstrative is that or those, right? So it's far away from you. You're pointing to something, that thing over there, those people over there, right? That's your far. Your near is this, you know, like this water bottle versus that water bottle, right? Or whatever. So your near demonstrative, again, it's very similar, but the you have your case ending, so it's autos. I'm sorry, hutas. Hutas, there's a rough breather there. Hutas, tuto, tuto, or tutu, tuto, tuton. Hoito, toitone, toitos, tois, toitus, tutus. Oh, man, I was struggling through that one. Well, that was hard. It's getting late in the afternoon, guys. So the near demonstrative, again, those are your forms. You'll see it a lot. The case endings tell you what form or what case it is and what the number is and gender. So your case, gender, number is going to be identified by your case endings. So again, your case endings come in really handy. But the this near demonstrative has, it begins with a tau in most of its singular forms and plural forms. But then your far demonstrative begins with, remember this from last week? Ek. So ek is, you think exit, right? They're ek, going out. So your far demonstrative is a kanos, a kanu, a kano, a kanon, a kanoi, a kanon, a kanois, a kanus. And then you got your feminine endings, neuter endings. All right, so that's just the far demonstrative in its various cases, various forms. But do you remember how these can be used? These are, I think John's favorite pronoun is the demonstrative pronoun. It's everywhere. I'm working back through. I think I told you that. I'm working through John. The other John? Is it your favorite? No. Yeah, you do. They pop up. They pop off the page. You're like, okay, that's not too bad. Man, but I'm retranslating through the Gospel of John, and I just finished 7. I started 7. I'm like in, that was yesterday, was John 7, 1 to, I don't know, 10. I think I got to verse 10. And everywhere in John's Gospel, he is using the near and the far demonstrative. And so a couple things to remember about that are just kind of fun for reading Greek. So first, we talked about emphatic pronouns, which is when either a demonstrative or a personal pronoun is attached to a verb. I myself am. Ego, eimi. I myself am the bread of life. Well, an intensive pronoun is similar, but it's where a noun, it's modifying, that is the pronoun, is modifying a noun rather than the verb. So this is known as an intensive pronoun. Basically, same idea. So John 3:28 is, this is, I was telling you earlier, this is the John the Baptist, his response to his disciples when they're asking him whether he is, well, they're upset that Jesus has more disciples than they do. So help me out. First word, someone read it and identify it. What is that? Altoi, well done. Okay, so good pronunciation. So what is that? It's a pronoun. What kind of pronoun?
Dative.
Good. So it's dative. Good, the oi ending. Yes. Yes. I need to double check that. That is still dative, isn't it? No, it's actually nominative, isn't it? It's nominative. The ois would be dative. That's tricky, because you're right. It has an I.
It's missing the sigma.
But it's missing the sigma. The dative would have a sigma on the end. So it's autoi, so that would be nominative plural. But then notice he begins with two pronouns, one right after the next. Autoi, and then what's the next word?
Humes.
Humes. So that is emphatic. He's using two pronouns, one right after the next. You yourselves. You yourselves. Moi, that's another pronoun. See how these pronouns are everywhere. What does moi mean? What kind of pronoun is that? That's your first. Good. First person dative. So you yourselves to me. Here's your verb. Witness. It's actually where we get the English word. Someone spell that out or sound it out and figure out. You'll figure out what English word we get from that.
Martyrete.
Martyr. Exactly. We get the English word martyr from the Greek word martyreo, which is to witness or to testify. And the idea is they testify even to death. And so it's a near and dear, you know, a word that ought to be near and dear to our heart. But you yourselves to me witness, hati, that, upon, I said. And then here's, I mentioned this earlier, this is the uk, a me, ego. So how would you say that? Uk, a me, ego. How would you translate that in English? I myself am not. So notice here is the intensive pronoun because it's two pronouns back to back. You yourselves to me witness that I said, and then here is the emphatic use of the pronoun because it's a pronoun attached to a verb. So he's redundant, right? I myself am not ha Christos. I myself am not the Christ. So notice he's really, you can almost hear his tone of voice. You yourselves know, I told you, you could witness this to me. I told you I am not the Christ. But, hati, and then this one, someone sound that one out. You will recognize it as you sound it out. That word right there. Yep. So it's the participle form. The menos is a participle form, but it's from apostello. Apostle is the noun. The verb is apostello, which is, what does that mean?
Go out.
Yeah, to send or to go out. To send. Right. Sent ones. Right? Apostle means sent one. And so the verb is to send. So here he says, I am not the Christ, but that, and it's, we haven't learned this yet, but it's participle, that one who sent me. But that I am being sent is actually, because there's the verb, I am being sent is actually how you would translate that. That I am being sent before, and then here's his use of the far demonstrative. I am being sent before that one. So he's referring to the Christ as that one. I am not the Christ. I am the one being sent before that one. Notice he's saying he's using the far demonstrative to refer to Christ, but he's distancing himself from Christ. I am not the Christ, but I'm sent before that one. That Christ, the Christ is coming. Yeah.
I don't mean to derail this, but I just have to ask this because I don't know you can answer it. But how can John, in one sense, be so convinced that he knows he's being sent before this one, and later have enough doubt that he sends disciples to Jesus?
Yeah.
Because here he's so emphatic, it's like,
very emphatic.
I know I'm being sent.
Yep. Yep.
I know this is the one.
Right.
And later he goes, are you?
Yep.
Is that just the human part of us that?
Yeah, I think so. I think to some degree, I mean, it's the human part because he's been rotten in prison for months by the time that, you know, he starts questioning that.
So it's thinking, but, all for
that. Mm-hmm. But I think even Jesus' ministry was different than he was expecting.
Yeah, we discussed that in his group once. You know,
right.
His messianic expectations were not being met by Jesus.
Exactly. Exactly. So he started even himself personally struggling.
Because, you know, we tend to, I'm speaking for myself, tend to look at these giants of the faith and whitewash over any human characteristics,
right,
and traits.
That's right.
And then something like that pops up and you go, but they were human.
They were human. That's right. That's exactly right. Which I think is it actually helps us read the narrative better. That, you know, this guy is, Jesus says, there's no one better born among women than John the Baptist. You know, that's high praise. But even John struggled to fully understand and comprehend and accept the messianic mission of Jesus. So, like, that helps us understand how dramatically disappointing Jesus was as a Messiah. Given the first century Jewish expectations for what the Messiah would be, they were dramatically disappointed. And even John was, you know, to a degree.
Well, because all the sects, whether it be Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, they all were awaiting this conquering deliverer.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's powerful commentary to that. Absolutely. So cool. But no, that's a good observation, because he is emphatic here.
Yeah, when you read that, it's just like, how could he
reveal
the other side of the coin when he's laying it out for his disciples here?
That's good. That's good. But you're right. He's human, and he struggles with it later. Absolutely. So, I have a couple more examples. I think we talked about those ones last week. Let's jump to this one. And then we'll finish pronouns. So notice how the far demonstrative is used often for distancing. That one. And sometimes even disassociating, which was this passage, the John 5:11, is the man who was healed, who is being confronted. You know, he was the lame man that was healed on the Sabbath, and he walks off carrying his bed. And then he's confronted by the religious leaders. Well, wait a minute, what are you doing? Why are you carrying your bed? And he says, well, that one told me, right? So it's like he's distancing himself from Jesus. It wasn't my fault. That guy. Yeah, I'm just doing what I told. It was that guy's fault, right? And it's like, and you can see that again, it's a subtlety that most of the time doesn't come across in English. Sometimes some English translations will bring it out, but it's much more stark in Greek.
So is it always, far demonstrative like that is always used? I mean, that seems negative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost like...
Almost derogatory.
Yeah, it's like he's distancing himself to diminish the other and elevate himself almost.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and it's often used that way. Not maybe every time, like it's context. You got to be sensitive to the context.
Yeah.
But very often it communicates that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the idea they're trying to get across.
Yeah, distance, disassociation. But then the opposite is also true. The near demonstrative is often used for closeness and intimacy. So notice, for instance, 1 John 5:20. It says, and we are in the true one, in his son, Jesus Christ. All right, that's that first line right up there. But then notice how he begins with the near demonstrative. Houtos, this, in other words, normally you would say he, because you just refer it to Jesus. And he says, he is the true God and eternal life. But here he uses the near demonstrative, which the near demonstrative it's emphatic. It's just the use of it is emphatic. But it's like he's saying, we are in the true one and his son, Jesus Christ. This one is indeed the true God and eternal life, which the nearest antecedent to that is Jesus. This is actually one of the deity of Christ passages, is that he just called Jesus the true God. I think it's kind of interesting. It says, we are in the true one and his son, Jesus Christ. This one is indeed the true God and eternal life. But notice he uses, instead of just saying he is the true one, he uses the near demonstrative. This one is indeed. Because again, and I use the word indeed there. Why? Because notice it's a pronoun attached to a verb. So he doesn't actually have to use that. You could just begin the sentence with estin. But he's saying this one is indeed. So there's the emphasis plus the demonstrative pronoun. And it's almost as if John is cherishing Jesus, holding him close, hugging him tight. This one is indeed. the true God and eternal life. And it's kind of, again, John loves the demonstrative pronoun. It's all over his writings. But you see how the demonstrative pronoun is a very effective tool in writing and communicating. And so always just be sensitive to it. And you're going to have a lot of fun reading John's gospel because he uses it everywhere. But, okay. But we've got just a few more pronouns to get through. All right. So we have indefinite, interrogative, reflexive, and reciprocal. All right. So we got four more pronouns. So the next two are very easily confused. You have an indefinite pronoun versus an interrogative pronoun. The indefinite is just, you would translate that someone or something, right? You would translate it someone if it's in the masculine or feminine, but something if it's in the neuter. You see that? So like the indefinite pronoun is tis, tinos, tina, tina, tinny, tina, and then tina. But then notice if it's in the neuter, neuter is genderless. So it would be things. That's how you would say something. Or a certain man. What narrative was I just reading? I think it says like a certain man. Oh, so like I think the Samaritan or the Good Samaritan parable starts that way. Right? A certain man went from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And it begins with an indefinite pronoun. Just someone. Right? It's unnamed. It's indefinite. Somebody, someone, something. And so your indefinite pronoun, so like keep your eyes on that. This is where it gets confusing, but there's a trick to help you remember. But the indefinite pronoun looks like that, while the interrogative looks like that. They're identical in form. There only is one difference. Do you see the difference? It's not necessarily the written iota, because these have iotas too. So it's
accent.
Exactly. It's the accent mark. So the accent mark is the only distinguishing characteristic between indefinite pronouns and interrogative pronouns. So an indefinite pronoun is someone, something, a certain man, a certain woman. But an interrogative is a question. Who? What? Why? Right? So that these are question pronouns. When you see that in a sentence, it's a question. You have to translate it like a question. It should be noted that, again, the accent is always acute. It always is found over the first iota in all of the interrogative pronoun forms. Notice the masculine and feminine forms are identical. And so, like, it's impossible to tell gender. So it's just either masculine, feminine, or neuter. So really, you're just seeing if it's personal or neuter. It's either masculine or feminine because those are exact same forms. Context, you have to figure that out by the context. Most of the time it doesn't matter, but sometimes it matters in the context. But most of the time, you know, it's pretty obvious. But then it's all, for me, it's easy to confuse these indefinite versus interrogative. But you just ask the question, and in asking the question, you answer it. I always ask the question, which one has the accent? Which one has the accent again? Exactly. You just asked a question. You just asked a question, and that is your answer, is the interrogative has the accent. All right? So indefinite versus interrogative. Which one has the accent again? It's the interrogative, because I just had to ask the question to figure that out. Right? And it's like, oh, that's kind of handy. So these are used, again, introduce direct or indirect questions like who, what, or the neuter is used to ask why, the reason why. So interrogative pronouns, again, they appear not as frequent as like personal pronouns, but they you'll see them quite a few times through the New Testament. Yes, sir?
I guess my question pertains to the last slide, the indefinite and the one you were on previously. Is it mostly context that determines whether it's like masculine versus neuter, since the case endings are...
Oh, yes. Yep, good question. Well, no, so masculine or feminine. Because the neuter has its own form. But not always, right? It has its own form in the nominative and the accusative.
Masculine and feminine are identical.
Exactly.
So that's totally reliant on context.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then like the date of the teeny and teeny, yeah, they're all the same.
Yep. But honestly, it most of the time doesn't matter because it is, you know, it's just a someone. Sometimes it's like a someone, but it's in the feminine. If context, you know, helps you, like if you're working your way through and you're like, oh, like there's women characters in this story, then maybe it's, you know, in the feminine. Sometimes you'll have an article there. Remember, the article never lies. So if there's an article attached, then you know if it's, you know, that will distinguish gender. But the pronoun itself is identical, like between masculine and feminine, which actually you got to just remember that. But it actually makes it easier because you only have to memorize one form. It's like, you know, so you don't have to memorize three genders, you know, or, you know, masculine, feminine, or neuter. You're really only memorizing two because masculine and feminine are identical. So, but then notice that, again, the accent mark gives away the interrogative, but be careful because in the plural, notice there is an accent mark over the epsilon in the indefinite pronoun, but in the interrogative, it moved to the iota. So it's the accent mark over the iota that is the giveaway, that is interrogative. All right, but again, those you're just memorizing vocab, and that's going to stick. So there's two different kinds of pronouns left, and then we'll move on to adjectives before our evening is out. So you have reflexive pronouns and reciprocal. Those are our last two. These ones are less common. They do show up, but they're not as common as the other ones. So you're not going to see them as frequently. But notice how it's basically the combination. So reflexive, do you know what a reflexive is? It's where it's you translate it myself, yourself, or himself. It's the word self on the end. So a reflexive pronoun is simply referring back to the subject. So like, I fed myself. Myself would be a reflexive pronoun. And notice how it's basically you're jamming together the possessive pronoun and the personal pronoun. Do you see that? Because like this, look at M out toe. Notice that first part, that looks like a possessive pronoun, M. And then out to is your personal pronoun. So it's like when you jam them together, now that's a reflexive pronoun. M out to, M out to, M out ton, M out to, M out to, M out ton. Or, set out to, set out to, set out ton. And so you have your M, which is your first person, your se, which is your second person, right? The sigma, the su, you, second person. So those are actually somewhat familiar. If you've memorized your other pronouns, you're like, okay, these are just jamming them together. That's reflexive. And then your third person looks like your third person personal pronoun, but it just has a rough breather and an epsilon in the front. So it's he out to, he out to, he out ton, he out tone, he out tois, he out tous for your masculine. So they're not that hard. They don't come up that frequently, but once you just see, oh wait, that looks like a personal pronoun, but there's an epsilon on the front. It's reflexive. So you would translate it self. So let me give you a couple examples of that. So first, this is John 5:26, Mark 5:30. So let's see, who wants to be brave? Who wants to read that first line or what I underlined? First word, sigma,
spare.
Well done, spare. And then?
Gar.
Ha.
Pater.
Good, pater, good. What does pater sound like? You know, party. You know that word? Party. Yeah, well, maybe, but. Yeah, it's actually padre. That's how I remember it. Pater is padre. It's father. Good. And then eke is second person, has. So you translate it for the father. We'll talk about it. Well, or I will now. There's a couple different Well, here in I think maybe next week or the week after, we're going to talk about conjunctions. Gar is a conjunction. De, there's a couple of them where they are postpositive, it's called. So like it's actually the second word in the sentence, but you always translate it at the beginning to make good English. So you would translate that for, as the Father has life, and then here's our, it's a prepositional phrase, but in he'alto. Good. There's our reflexive pronoun. Yep. So as the Father has life in himself, this is houtos, thus or so. Kai, do you remember what kai is? I think I was on our vocab quiz last week, wasn't it?
And also.
Good. And also or even. So in this context, which one would you make? Which one makes most sense? How would you translate kai?
Even.
Yeah. Thus, I'd probably say also, but maybe even. But thus, also, to hui o. To huio.
Son.
Good. So as the Father has life in himself, thus or so also the Son. Oh, man. We'll talk about this later. You'll figure them out, but that's one of the toughest verbs. It's one of the most frequent verbs in the New Testament, but it's a me verb, and man, the forms are so funky. But
is that from a you?
Didymi.
Oh,
didymi,
okay.
Didymi. So it's the has given. So in other words, the Father has given the Son life to have, and then notice the same prepositional phrase, in himself. So this is actually a really important passage when it comes to Christology, because it's saying that in himself, that reflexive pronoun is really important. God has life in himself, and he has given to the Son to have life in himself. So the Father and the Son have self existent life. I make a big deal of that in different teaching settings, but self-existence is an attribute of God. Like he doesn't have needs, right? He doesn't need food, water, shelter, and he didn't get life from a pre-existing source. You and I got life from a pre-existing source. It's not, you know, there's not spontaneous combustion of life. It doesn't just erupt onto the scene. But here, it's describing the Father and the Son have life in themselves, in himself. And so it's the idea of self-existent, self-sustaining life, which is inherent to deity. It's an attribute of the divine.
What is that work that the Father gave the Son life?
Mm-hmm. So, good question. It's kind of it's a deep question, and it gets into the depths of the Trinity, right? Like, how does that work? Mm-hmm. There's different,
little question, it's fine.
Yeah, I know, I was going to say, yeah, that's a great question.
Well, because it wouldn't be like, when God gave life to mankind, no,
right.
Life into him, it's not the same here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different.
Because it's eternal, which means
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the beginning.
Exactly. So this is actually a really big hot topic in theology right now, is the eternal generation of the Son. So like what, that's the subject it's called. And so that's where it's a big question you're asking. And there's good people on both sides. But the question is, what, when and where did Jesus become the Son of God? Right? Is like, and that's a big question. There's some that say the term title Son of God only applies to Jesus in his humanity. Yep, exactly. Right.
He's talking about giving life in the incarnation. Life is already there.
Right. And that is a very attractive position, because it helps sidestep really the issue. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because I'm still struggling over it, but I think it doesn't necessarily answer all the questions. It does in some passages, but there's other passages and other just theological concepts, like it calls, a couple passages calls God the eternal Father. Well, to be a father, you need a son, mm-hmm. right? And so like there's something in the relationship between Father and Son that has been eternal, that predates the incarnation.
But mm-hmm. is that just because it was always going to happen?
Exactly. That you could be saying it in, what do they call that term?
Like
proleptically.
That
yep.
These are the kind of questions that blow your brain out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and there are whole theological treatises written to debate this point. That's a very good question. But it is attractive to say, you know, the incarnation, you know, Son of God title is an allusion to his incarnation.
Which actually always was before the foundation.
Right, because it was always planned. Even if it didn't, you know, happen in our view of time. Right, but it was in eternity, because it's timeless, right? Then it's outside of time. Then it was always the case. Yep. Which is, that's a attractive way of saying it. But in fact, John and I, it's on our to-do list, because John and Andrew and I, on one of our Wednesday lunches, we're going to spend the time debating this, because this came up. I don't know, was anyone here for Daniel McCoy's ordination? So the eternal sonship of the Son came up, because it's a hot topic. And Daniel did a great job. He answered it well, but he actually sided with the other position, not the incarnation one. Yeah. But he's tentative, you know, because he's like, you know. Yeah, holds it loosely. But it's a big debate, is where does that happen? So, good question. But I wish we could spend more time on that. But let's look at Mark 5 real quick. So Mark 5, 30. Anyone want to take a stab at that? First few words. Close. It does look like an N. The N.
Uthus.
Good. Uthus. Well done. Good. Why don't you just do the whole line? The first line. First line. You're like, man, you're rocking it. Keep going.
This is the word that I struggle with.
Good. That's what we're looking at. That's our reflexive pronoun.
Sorry. Tain.
Good.
Oh, what's this word? Okay. How do you pronounce the second?
X. So X. So it'd be, that's an epsilon and then a xi.
Okay.
So it's like the X, the,
yeah, that's the
KS sound or an X sound.
I always struggle with. Is that what do you, letter? What would that be?
Yeah, letter. It's just a letter. Yeah, the xi.
And then L2. Dunamin.
Good. Well done, my man. Okay. So, translation. And immediately, that uthus, that second word, that uthus, that's part of Mark's idiolect, right? We used that term earlier. And it's translated immediately. It's one of the most frequent words in the Gospel of Mark. That's why they call it Mark is a fast-paced gospel. This, and immediately. This happened. So it's, and immediately Jesus, epigenus. Anyone know what that is? It's from gnosis, gnosko. Excuse me, say it again.
Perceive.
Yeah, perceive or to know. Yep. So Jesus knew or perceived, and then there's our reflexive pronoun. En heauto, in himself. That out of him, ex autu, dunamin. What's dunamin? Does anyone know what dunamin? It's from dunamis. Oh, close. That's duo. Dunamin is power, right? So it's, you know, the one we always say is it's dynamite. Exactly. And it's, and now. Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think it actually goes the other way, though. I think our English word dynamite does come from Greek. But when they, yeah, you've heard preachers say the Romans 1:16, right? It's the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. And so, and it's the word dunamis. So they say, well, Paul was thinking about dynamite. And it's like, okay, wait, dynamite didn't exist yet,
some,
right?
Exactly.
It's like Paul was not thinking about dynamite, okay?
Yeah,
but
that's a prophet.
Yeah, that's a legit prophet. That's impressive. Okay, so second line. Anyone want to take a stab at that? Whoop. So, and immediately Jesus, knowing in himself that out of him power, that's actually then the verb is right here. That's a tough one. Okay, but
XL Thusan.
Good. XL Thusan, which is, we'll talk about it, means to go out, because it means to come or go, but then the ek on the front, so to go out. So power, out of him, power went out. So it's actually the word out shows up twice.
Is that from that echo name? Is that the original?
Ek. Yeah, I think it's from Ek Erkamai. I think it's Erkamai. But then when you change forms, we'll talk about in verbs, like that is a funky word. So it actually turns into the Elthusan, like the El, it changes the root, totally changes spelling. And there's half a dozen words like that that are very common words in the Greek New Testament that are so funky. Like they don't even look like the original word because of all the augmentation that's happening. And so those ones are tough, but they happen frequently enough that you start recognizing them the more you read. And so it's, we'll talk about it when we get to verbs, but.
Is it the rule of thumb that which is most frequent is also the most irregular?
Yeah, there's some truth to that. Yes. Yeah. Some of the most frequently used words are irregular in their form. Yeah, they're just weird. So, but don't be discouraged. It becomes obvious the more you read. But Jesus, knowing within himself, there's our reflexive, in himself, that out of him power went out. And then
epistrapsis.
Yep. That's the word turning about in the crowd, or to the crowd, or amidst the crowd. He said, and then here's our question. Does anyone recognize what's this one right here? Tis. Tis. How would you translate that?
Who?
Good. So it's which one? Is it indefinite or interrogative pronoun?
Interrogative.
Good, because it has that accent mark over to the iota. So it's who, me, or who of me touched the garment. Actually, the garments. I think that's plural. So he would say, who touched my garments? The garments of me. Who touched my garments? Who touched me? Right? So remember, what narrative is that?
That's the woman with the issue of blood.
Exactly. That's so good. Excellent. But, and I don't know what this was like. My imagination goes wild. But it says he knowing in himself, right, the reflexive pronoun, that power went out of him. Like he felt something.
Well, when he poses the question, his disciples are like, are you kidding? Everybody's touching you.
I love that scene. They're like, why would you ask that? Why?
We're in Washington.
That's right. That's right. Oh, it's cool.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
She responds immediately. She's not.
Oh, she knows. Yeah, because she was the one who touched him. And then she thought she could get away with it. And then he's like, wait a minute. And he stops the whole procession.
Well, because, like, when Elise said to you, were voted for touching.
That's right.
She knows.
So wait till we get to participles. I almost shared this one tonight, but we're not there yet. The verse right before this is one of the coolest in the New Testament, where it's the longest, if I remember right, it's the longest pre-verbal participle chain in the New Testament. It's like five or six participles in a row that are, it's describing all of her thoughts right before she touches him. And it's so cool, because they're all in participles, so they're backgrounded information, or they're pre-verbal, so it's telling you, you know, all the circumstances that she was in before she actually touches him. And it's one of the most elaborate sentences in the New Testament, one of the longest participle chains. So we'll get there when we talk about participles, but that is a cool narrative. And Mark, for some reason, is such a storyteller. You know, I think, and it's Peter, you know, Mark's writing it down, but I mean, that he's the way he tells stories in Mark is really cool. Lots of details, loves participles. And so it can be, you know, it can be a little dense for new Greek students because they're like, man, there's a lot of participles in here. But before long, you know, once you kind of catch on to that, it's fun reading because it's very vivid reading. You know, it adds a lot of detail and it's kind of fun.
Is it because Mark writes that way or because Peter talks that way?
That's a good question. That's a fair question.
I have Peter in Greek, so I wonder.
I
Well, that's another whole thing.
I think it's because Peter talks that way, because doesn't Mark contain the most actual Aramaic sayings of Christ?
Yep.
Because
that's also true.
Quoting Christ
yep.
directly.
Yep. And that's a good question, because it's different, though, because like when you read First Thing of Peter, it's quite a bit different than Mark. But it makes sense. Mark's the penman to Mark. The thought is Peter. But then even there's a big difference between First and Second Peter. And the belief is that he had, because I think he mentions, is it First? I think it's First Peter 5, he mentions Silvanus. And so, exactly. So you actually probably don't see Peter's pen till Second Peter. So you see Mark's pen, Silvanus's pen, and then you see Peter's pen.
And do you think they're all different?
They are, yeah. The style is different. And so, and especially when you get to 1 Peter. Like, remember we talked about the article, was that 2 weeks ago or last week? We talked about the article. Like, Peter is so strange in that. He'll dangle an article, and then the noun is over here. And he will put, like, 4 or 5 things in between the article and its noun. And it's a really unique way of writing, but it's very Petrine. 1 Peter shows up all over. You know, and it's kind of cool since you got me on it, you know. We don't need to go long on this, but it's so like 1 Peter, I think it's chapter 5 is a good example of this. Yeah, right here. So notice this phrase right there. Ha kai tes meluses apokaluptesai testai doxes koinonas. So it's technically, you would translate that, the, and also, or the partaker of the glory that will be revealed. That's how we say it in English, but in Greek it's the, also the about to be revealed glory partaker. Does that make sense? So it's Peter. It's like Peter is just weird that way, like, so like I have them boxed out. So the ha and the koinonos go together. That's the article and its noun. But he has this whole string of sentence, you know, in between. And the about to be revealed glory, I'm a partaker. So he's referring to himself. Because he says earlier, he says, I, the elders who are among you, I exhort one also being an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and the about to be revealed glory, a partaker. But it's just like he has several of those in Peter. And you're like, what in the world? Like, it's just, it, you know, it's confusing. But then once you realize it's part of the idiolect of at least 1 Peter, so which might be Silvanus, you know, his pen, then you're like, okay. Then you kind of start catching on as you're reading 1 Peter. That's just the way he thinks. You know, that's the way he, you know, the grammar he prefers, which is just, again, the New Testament is a smorgasbord of different writers and different styles, and it's kind of fun. But anyways, glad you asked. Isn't that fun? So much fun. Okay, but we have one more pronoun to talk about, and then I don't know, it's 4:30. We might be able to get to adjectives. Okay, so the final pronoun is the reciprocal pronoun. Now, this one's not too bad because there's only 3 forms of it, okay? And they're there. Allelon, allelois, allelus.
Isn't this one one another?
Yes, exactly.
It's like all alone, but you're with one another.
With one, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Is that how you remember?
Yeah.
Okay. Do y'all hear that? That was a good memory cue. Say it again.
It says allelon, but it means one another.
Exactly. So you see that? He just spelled out the English or the Greek word allelon, but it sounds like English all alone, but it means one another. Right? So you're not alone. You're all together. That's good. I like that. So a reciprocal pronoun is just, it's limited to the masculine gender. That's the only gender that shows up in the New Testament. I mean, theoretically, there are feminine and neuter, but they don't appear in the New Testament. So only the masculine, only those 3 forms. And they're always in the plural because there's always 2 parties involved, one another. There's more than one person involved. And so it only appears in the plural, the masculine plural. Allelon, allelois, allelus. Does that make sense? So those are the only 3 forms of it. Shows up in the New Testament. But you would translate that one another, which is, there's a lot of, you know, cool examples of this. But like the one another commands, right, that we talk about so much in the New Testament, like the local church. Love one another. Be hospitable one to another. Help me out. There's like 15 of them, I think, in the New Testament, something like that. There's a bunch 31. Of them. 31.
Yep.
Well, there we go. Well done. Way to know that off the top of your head.
The 31 one another passages in the New Testament.
Oh, there we go. 31. Wow. There it is.
One for every day of the month?
It's like Proverbs. Right, right. Read a chapter in Proverbs and a one another command every day of the month. I like that. So the one another commands, that's the reciprocal pronoun. Love one another. Yeah, again, be hospitable to one another. I don't know if you can think of another one, but there's a bunch of them. 31. That's what a reciprocal pronoun. All right, it's the one another. So one more exercise, and then we'll get off pronouns. So this verse, identify and name four different pronouns in Mark 4:41. What are they? I'll give you a moment. Kai, Epha, Bethason, Phabon, Megan, Kai, Elegan, Pras, Elelus, Alelus, Tis, Ara, Hutas, Estin, Hati, Kai, Ha, Animas, Kai, He, Thalesa, what? Hoop, Akue, Auto. English, and they feared with a great fear, and they said to one another, who then is this? For even the wind and the sea obey him. So where are your four? Can anyone find one? Where are your four?
Two.
Say it again.
Found two.
Okay, which ones?
Utas.
And you're like, oh, he took mine.
Auto.
So Utas, the right here.
Yeah.
And then what was the other one you found?
Auto.
Oh, the last word in the sentence?
Uh-huh.
Right there. Okay, good. There's two. Ah, good. And right there. Good. Okay. So let's take them in order. The first one that appears, the last one I circled, is what kind of pronoun? That was the last one we just talked about. All alone. Yeah, you got it. It's the reciprocal pronoun. Good. So it says, in other words, they feared with a great fear and said to one another. So the disciples are looking at each other and they're kind of, again, they're murmuring amongst themselves, but this is an internal conversation among the disciples because you have that reflexive pronoun. They said to one another, and then tis. What kind of pronoun?
It's a question. Interrogative.
Good. That's your question because it has that accent mark over the iota. So who, ara, then, who, then, and then third pronoun. What kind is that? Hutas. Good. So is it near or far? Good. Near demonstrative. So who is this? Right? I even have it italicized in my translation. Who then is this that also, or even, this would actually be a good place where Kai would probably be even, that even the wind and the sea obey auto. What kind of pronoun is that? It looks like a near demonstrative, but it has an alpha instead of an omicron on the front. So it's not near demonstrative. It's third person personal pronoun, him. That even the wind and the sea obey him. But notice it's kind of cool. They use that near demonstrative again. Who is this? For even the wind and the sea obey him. Like they're just in awe. Like this is right after Jesus stills the storm. Remember, he's asleep in the back of the boat, gets up, stills the storm, and they're like, whoa, who is this? And they're saying this to one another, right? That reciprocal pronoun. Well done, class. Okay, pronouns, you whipped those. That's easy. All right? No problem whatsoever. Okay, so I got 24 minutes. It shouldn't take too long. Let me just, there's not a lot to talk about with adjectives, but let me just introduce adjectives. And there's only a couple things you really need to know. But what are adjectives? So let's just tackle another part of speech in 25 minutes. Adjectives are words or phrases that modify nouns. So they add additional meaning. That's a spell check. Didn't catch me there. They add additional meaning to the noun. Things such as tall, short, long, soft, hard, whatever, right? I like the weak guy there. When he's trying to flex and his muscles falling down, right? Yeah, right? It's like so cartoon. I think of Bugs Bunny or something. But like nouns, adjectives also possess gender, number, and case so that they can correspond to the nouns that they modify, right? So again, this is really your last major part of speech. This is really your last major part of speech where your case endings come in handy, all right? So again, just by way of review, case endings are important for what major parts of speech? Nouns, right? Pronouns. We just talked about pronouns.
Adjectives.
And then article. The article will use your case endings as well. So those are your four major parts of speech that use case endings. So if you can learn those case endings, like I said, you're halfway there to learning, you know, most of your, you know, half your major parts of speech. So adjectives will also use case endings because they have to correspond to the noun that they describe. So there's approximately 7,788 adjectives in the New Testament. Adjectives add so much to language. You always can spot a preacher because they use a lot of adjectives. They add color, texture, vividness, intensity to normal nouns. The New Testament is very rich in adjectives. So when it comes to just exegetical, you know, study and reading, learn to appreciate the color, clarity, intensity that adjectives bring to the table in the exegetical process. So just random examples that just kind of came to my mind. Acts 27:14, it's not just a wind, it's a violent wind, right? That's the shipwreck of Paul scene in Acts 27. It's not just a wind, it's a violent wind. So a violent is an adjective. It's telling you something more about the wind. Romans 7, the law of God or the commandment is, and he uses three adjectives in a row, holy, righteous, and good. Notice, and again, that's always significant as well. It's not just an adjective, but especially when they pile up adjectives, like Hebrews 7:25. We don't just have a high priest, but we have one who is holy, harmless, undefiled. And then it actually keeps going because it says separate from sinners, etc. But those aren't adjectives. They're used in an adjectival sense, but they're participial phrases. We'll talk about participles later. But a participle can be used as an adjective. And we'll talk about that later. But 1 Peter 1:4, I love this one. It talks about the inheritance that we have as saints. The inheritance is incorruptible, undefiled, and unfading. I mean, it's just... And Peter loves adjectives. I mean, those are fun. And those are very Petrine. He just adjective after adjective, you know, the Lamb of God is spotless, blameless, undefiled, right? I mean, it's like he's throwing out these adjectives all over the place. So there are primarily three types of adjectives. The first is called an attributive adjective. It's telling you an attribute about something. So the good man is an attributive adjective. It's telling us an attribute about the man, the good man. But you can also turn that into a predicate adjective, which means the good man is an incomplete thought. It's not a sentence. But you can turn it into a sentence and say the man is good. The idea remains the same, right? But the adjective is used as the predicate of the sentence. Are you familiar with that term? I know that's like high school English class, but subject versus predicate of the sentence. Subject is your actor, so it's the first part of the sentence in English, and then the predicate is the end of the sentence. It's typically the verbal idea and the object upon which the action is being made. But an adjective, and I'll show you how this looks in Greek in just a second, but an adjective and a noun can actually form a full sentence in Greek. Because you don't even need a verb. It can be an implied verb, like the ame verb right in the middle. So the man is good is a complete sentence. And so that's known as the predicate use of the adjective. And then the third major category of adjectives is that it can be a substantive adjective. And this is where you turn an adjective into a noun most often by putting an article in front of it. So like, I don't know if you ever heard the movie title, right? The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Okay, that's a good example of a substantive adjective. So, because good, bad, and ugly are adjectives. But when you put a noun in front of it, or I'm sorry, an article in front of it, it turns it into a noun idea. So the good, the bad, the ugly. So that you take an adjective and you're basically turning it into a noun, a substance. Does that make sense? So those are your three major uses of adjectives. And the way that you tell the difference between those three, these three types of adjective functions are determined by the relation of the adjective to its noun and the presence or the absence of the article. So what do I mean by that? Well, let's just look at this chart, this table. You just got to stare at it for a few minutes, but it starts making sense. So when you have, like, notice, let's just look at the top left and just kind of work our way through the chart. Your attributive adjective is the good man. Notice, ha agathos anthropos would be your Greek phrase. And this is an article with the adjective followed by the noun. The good man. You would translate that into English just the way it looks like in Greek. The good man. However, if both, so in other words, if there's an article, then an adjective, then a noun, it's attributive. If you have, so like just move over the next box, still on the attributive, but now we're looking at the, it's known as the second position. You have article, noun, article, adjective. Ha anthropos, ha agathos. So that is the man, the good. Technically, you know, that would be kind of your unpolished way of saying it. The man, the good. But because they both have the article, it's also attributive. So you would still translate that, the good man. You can also front the noun to in front of. So like number three there on the top row, column three, you can also put the noun first, then the article, then the adjective. Anthropos, ha, agathos, the good man. All right, so notice you got several options of how you can say it in Greek. But then notice, second column now, or second row down, predicate. This is agathos ha anthropos, is where you put the adjective, then the article, then the noun. So notice the adjective does not have an article. And in that case, you would translate that, the man is good. It's a complete thought. You also could do it, again, second predicate position, article, noun, adjective, ha anthropos, agathos. Notice the article is attached to the noun, the man, but then there's no article on the adjective. So you would translate that implied verb is, a be verb, the man is good. All right, those are your most common ones right up here, kind of your top section right up here. Those are the most common forms you're going to see.
Sorry, what does first, second, third stand for in the top?
So it's just called first, second, and third position.
Position.
Attributive position. Yeah, so they're talking about three different ways that it can be attributive. If it's like, and they're just referring to the sequence, article, adjective, noun, article, adjective, noun, article, adjective, right? So like there's three different ways that it can still all be translated the good man, but those are three different word orders that you might find it in, if that makes sense.
So the make or break is just the article with the adjective. If it's there, it's
correct. So studying this, there's just a couple of big ideas that you need to remember. Don't waste your brain power trying to memorize that chart, okay? I'm just showing you, the chart shows you the broad possibilities of what it can mean. But the big ideas is, number one, if the article is attached to the adjective, then it will be attributive. So this is sometimes called the AAA rule. I heard one guy refer to it as that. which is an adjective preceded by an article, is attributive. So in other words, the good man. So if the adjective has the article, it'll be attributive, the good man. But if the article is attached to the noun, but not the adjective, it's predicate. So that is like that would be like right here. The man is good. Which one has the article? It's with the noun, ha anthropos. But the adjective stands alone, it has no article. So if it doesn't have an article, it's normally predicate. So you'd say the man is good. And notice here is the same thing. Ha anthropos agathos is again, notice article, noun, and then an adjective without an article. So that would also be predicate. So if the article is attached to the noun but not the adjective, it's predicate. If it's attached to, if the article is attached to the adjective, then it's attributive. That's your big rule. And if you translate the predicate adjective, then you must supply a linking verb, is, are, was, were, something like that, if it's not already in the text. Sometimes the text will have a form of a me, it's a be verb in the sentence, but often it just is just a adjective and a noun. And so you have to supply the verb is. The man is good. All right. Now, so that is most often what you will encounter is the article. The article really is what gives it away. The bottom half of the chart is what happens, and it's less common, but it does happen, and that's where you'll have an adjective and a noun, but with neither of them have articles. There is no article in the clause. And so typically, when your adjective becomes first, just like in English, a good man. Agathos anthropos is a good man. So that's very similar to English. When normally in English word order, we put the adjective before the noun. And so that can happen in Greek. But it also can happen the other way around. Because in Greek, it, you know, anthropos, agathos, it, you know, it can flip-flop it. And so notice that is just the bottom half of that chart. Don't get confused by it. It's just context is what determines it. It's not hard to see. Like on a chart, that gets frustrating. You're like, well, which one is it? Because they're the same, you know, forms. Agathos, anthropos can be attributive or predicate. Yeah, but in a sentence, you'll see that. Because if there's another main verb, then it's probably attributive. The good man did such and such, right? Because it's attached to another main verb. But if it's a standalone clause and there is no other main verb in the sentence, then you're like, well, okay, it's probably predicate. The man is good, right? So that's where context really helps you. When there's no article, you have to have context. When there is an article, then it tells you which is which. Does that make sense? If the article is attached to the adjective, it's attributive. If the article is attached to the noun, it's predicate. All right? Questions on that? It's kind of, I know, it's late. But that's really the only main rule that you need to know for adjectives is that the article rules there. And is the article attached to the adjective or the noun? And then is it attributive or predicate? So context makes it pretty clear. All right, so a couple examples of this, of like the substantive adjectives. So if there's an adjective standing alone in sentence without a noun to modify it, then the adjective can function as a noun itself. Most of the time, a substantive adjective will have an article, but sometimes they don't. So this is the one I gave you a while back. This is in the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6:13. We talked about this, three weeks ago. Notice Jesus is praying. He says, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from, and it's right here, to paneru. So paneru, it's in the genitive. The nominative would be paneros. Paneros is an adjective. It just means evil. But when you put an article in front of it, the evil, remember, it's just like the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? You just put an article in front of the adjective, turns it into a noun idea. And so that's where a lot of your modern English translations will translate that do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Because it's a masculine article attached to the adjective. Does that make sense? So it's the evil one. And some will even just translate that devil, because that's who it's being referred to. I prefer evil one, because the word devil's not in there, right? I mean, it's like, that's a different Greek word. That's diabolos. So this is, it's best translated from the evil, I think one is probably the better translation, because it's a substantive adjective.
If you put the devil, it's just, you're putting who, you're assuming it implies.
Correct.
But it's not actually in the text.
Correct, right. So to be truest to the text, you would say the evil, but you can say the evil one because the article is in front of the adjective. And so that is good translation. Deliver us from the evil one. And so it's kind of interesting, but adjectives can be, again, attributive, predicate, or substantive. And that's just a good example of the substantive use of the adjective. There actually is, I mean, kind of another use. It's often lumped with the three uses. But there also can be an adverbial use of the adjective, where sometimes an adjective can modify a verb instead of a noun. Most of the time, adjectives modify nouns. Right? Jeff is short. That would be predicate, okay? Andrew is tall. But that is the normal use of it. But occasionally, you'll see an adjective attached to a verb. So it'll be functioning like an adverb, although it's technically an adjective. So like a good example is that Matthew 6:33. He says, but seek first the kingdom of God. And first is technically an adjective, but here it's actually used as an adverb. It's attached to a verbal idea. Seek first the kingdom of God. John 10:10 is another example. I am come that they might have life and that they might have it abundantly. So there I have it just bolded in the Greek, but that is actually abundant is an adjective, right? Now you could turn it into a noun. Abundance is a noun, but abundant is an adjective. But here he's using it in almost an adverbial sort of way, that they might have life and that they might have it abundantly. All right. And then there, other than this, there's only two other forms that you will see occasionally, not that often. But an adjective can also appear in a comparative or superlative. We do the same thing in English, right? Is that we would say, you know, short, but shorter, right? So I'm short, but there are, my children are shorter. I almost talked about John. No, I'm short, but John is shorter. Are you shorter than me? Maybe I'm shorter than him. Okay, all right. Yeah, I was going to say. All right, so now we can put it in the superlative. Jeff is the shortest. Okay.
How would you tell your children?
I know, she's about to pass me. So's Keith. Yeah, they're like any day now, they're going to pass me up.
Put rocks on their head.
That's right, I got to slow them down, slow them down. Now, again, most of the time, out of the, again, 7,788 adjectives in the New Testament, 7,399 of them are in the normal sense. It's called the positive form of the adjective. It's just an adjective. Tall, short, you know, whatever. But there are 198 of them, so not that frequent, but 198 times you'll see it in the comparative. That would be in English, we would say that's where you add the ER, right? You're adding, you know, you're comparing two things, and you have short versus shorter, strong versus stronger, soft versus softer, you know, whatever. So the comparative appears 198 times. The superlative, 191 times. That would be like shortest, tallest, right? So it's like it's talking about in a group of three or more. It is the superlative. So the only thing you really need to know is that these are the endings that are attached to an adjective when it goes to a comparative form. So this is, so for instance, the Greek adjective kainos just means new. But kainateros, which would be masculine, kainatera, feminine, kainateron would be neuter. Those three forms, it's just masculine, feminine, neuter, but it's saying it's the comparative form. So it would be newer versus new. Does that make sense? So an example of that, I just threw this one in there because I was translating through John and I came across one. And I was like, oh, John 4:52. It's when Jesus healed the nobleman's son. And it says, in that hour, he got better. It's kind of interesting. But see, I put it in bold, but I'm circling it now. It means, but notice it has the teron ending to it. So he got better is actually how you would translate that. So teros, tera, teron are your comparative forms. And then here's your superlative. And with this, we're done. But the superlative degree endings are tatas, tate, tatan, right there. So it's masculine, feminine, neuter. But when that is added to the stem, it's the superlative. So like, again, back to our kainos adjective, new. Kainatatas, right here. Kainatate and kainatatan would be newest. Not newer, but newest. Akrabes means strict, but akrabestas, akrabestatas is strictest. Does that make sense? So whenever you see an adjective and it has like that really long, you know, ending attached to it, then if it has a row, then it's ER. That's how I remember it, okay? Is the teros, tera, teron, it has a row in there, so just like an English ER. It's better. Teros, tera, teron. And then your tatas, tata, ta, tate, tatan, is your superlative. So it's the best, newest, strictest, tallest, strongest, whatever. Does that make sense? So that's the only other thing that you need to know about adjectives, is they can show up in, it's called the positive, comparative, or superlative form. Just their normal form, the ER ending, better, and then the superlative, best. All right? Any questions on that? Because you all are now experts on adjectives, right? There's not a whole lot to talk about with adjectives other than just vocab. Memorize your vocabulary, and you will find your most common adjectives. But any thoughts, questions, comments on that? Because it's right at 5. I'm out of time. What's that?
Clear as mud.
Clear as mud. Well done. Okay. Well done. It's all Greek to me, he says. All right. So then next week, we'll come back and we will start adverbs, negatives, and conjunctions. But then after that, I think we can cover all of those because there's not a lot to know. I mean, they're kind of like adjectives.
In the first hour.
Oh, yeah. No problem. We're going to cover that. No problem. Yeah. But once we get through adverbs, negatives, conjunctions, and there's some cool stuff to learn, especially about negatives. Negatives are fun in the Greek New Testament. Very precise. But then we'll also talk about prepositions. One of my favorite charts in New Testament Greek, we'll study that together, is prepositions. Tells you, all the different relationship words. And so we'll talk through prepositions. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Which hybrid did I have to get knocked off in the first pass through the liver?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, right. I'm glad that came to your mind.
That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, it didn't remind me of that.
It did, because I used to be the same sweats when I would look at it.
Oh, yeah, right. He's like, I just broke out in hives. Oh, yeah. God. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's hilarious. So we're only going to give it probably 2 more weeks, and I think we can get through adverbs, negatives, conjunctions, and prepositions in the next 2 weeks. And then we're into verbs, right? So like you've mastered, you know, most of your yeah, exactly. Then we get to the hard stuff, okay? This has all been warm up, okay? And the verbs get much more complicated, but it's not too bad if you just bite size it. You know, verbs aren't bad, but it's it definitely makes the other parts of speech look easy once you jump into verbs. What's that?
Is anything like Latin?
Is it the same?
Verbs are hard.
Yeah, it's pretty much universal. Any language, it's that way. Verbs are just tough. There's so many different forms of the verb, but they're also the workhorses of the language, right? I mean, like, you need verbs to say anything significant. So it's, I don't know. It just is what it is. But we'll definitely work on verbs. But it looks like, I mean, I think we only need 2 more weeks to finish the other parts of speech, the other major parts of speech. Then we'll jump into the verb, and we'll spend a lot of time on verbs. But once you, again, I mean, I hope, you know, you're having fun so far, keeping up as best you can on your vocab, dabbling in reading a little bit. What's a lot of fun is once you kind of get through a lot of the grunt work of the first, you know, 12, 15, you know, lessons or whatever, then it starts getting really fun because we start getting translating. We start getting into the Greek New Testament, spending a lot more time. I'm trying to, you know, whet your appetite by giving you verses and helping us work through and see significant things. But it is so much fun to just open your Bible, go to a passage, and just start working your way through it. So that's what, you know, if we're faithful enough and ambitious enough, that'll really be kind of the second half of the class, or at least maybe the last third, is we'll just start doing a bunch of translating. And then we'll see. Like, if y'all are total Greek nerds by then maybe we'll just start doing a Greek reading group. You know, we've talked about it a couple times, and I think Zoe is pretty excited about the possibility. So, and we're just like, even if it was just once or twice a month, like, we just get together like this on a Sunday afternoon, and we just start working our way through the Greek of a New Testament book. And there's so much to see. It's a lot of fun. So, all right. Any thoughts, questions, comments before we wrap it up? Okay, all done. John, welcome to class. You want to close us in prayer?
Absolutely.
Okay, fire away.
Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that as we work through the Greek language, we gain more access and understanding to the truth that's in your word. I just ask that as we continue through this, that you would grant encouragement to those who are working on this and help us all to learn well. We love you, Father. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.